Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Test Tubes and Cauldrons, a podcast where we talk about the science behind spirituality. I'm Astra.
I'm Fel.
And I'm Honey.
And today, we're going to talk about everybody's favorite topic, at least those of us who are into true crime, which is cults. but before we do that, I'm going to pass it over to Hanny, who's going to do our What Happened on This Day.
Okay, so today is currently the 9th of June, and I've chosen two events for today because they seem equally salient. So it's the birthday of both Henry Dale and Elizabeth Garrett Anderson. Henry Dale was born in 1875, and he was notable for his isolation of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine from ergot fungi. You might remember ergot from our episodes on entheogens, as its effects on diverse neurological systems can cause hallucinations, and as such, it's been proposed as an explanation for historical religious experiences, although we kind of get into why that might not be so robust. Dale subsequently shared the 1936 Nobel Prize in Medicine for his research on how acetylcholine could affect electrical stimulation, setting the groundwork for our current understanding of how synapses drive nerve impulses. I also chose Elizabeth Garrett Anderson. She's worth a mention because she's somewhat of a feminist hero. Born in 1836, she was denied access to medical schools but studied privately, including dissecting cadavers in her own room. Studying privately allowed her to become the first woman licensed as a medical practitioner in Britain. Active in the suffragette movement, she was also the first female member of the British Medical Association, the first female mayor, the first female dean of medical school. I could go on. Her legacy survives in her 1866 hospital in Whitechapel, London, which was the first hospital to be staffed by women, and it remains open to this day. It's also the date where Kraft cheese was patented, so we contain multitudes.
That's the real important fact of the day, is that it's the day that Kraft cheese was created. No, I'm kidding. Fel, do you want to do the content warning?
Sure. So as you can tell by the channel, just a general content warning for obviously talking about cults, high control groups, as well as what that entails, things like talking about brainwashing. If there's anything that's especially harrowing, we'll give a 30-second or so, skip ahead if you want to skip things, but just a general warning that we will be talking about cults in the cult episode.
Yeah, so why did we decide to talk about this topic? Like, was it something that each of you wanted to cover? And if so, kind of why? What is the relevance, you think, to the spiritual community? If it's not, already blaringly obvious.
Yeah, I actually did a video on my channel with other YouTuber Aaliyah Kai about Discord cults, because I had personally noticed like this rise and like, and we'll get into like what defines a cult, but to use the term more loosely, finding that a lot of Discord communities would like turn into like weird cults where like you're not allowed to question anything. So I have noticed its presence in online spaces. Obviously not as bad as like many historical examples, but like it still causes a lot of distress. So I think it's extremely relevant in the modern spiritual world, especially now that things are so spread out online. There can be like a bunch of micro cults, essentially.
I wanted to do this episode for ages because I'm kind of, without sounding morbid, I'm kind of morbidly obsessed with cults. Like, I find the psychology behind them really, really interesting. And I think they're relevant to spirituality in the sense that a lot of cults have somewhat been defined by having alternative spiritual beliefs. But as we'll kind of discuss in this episode, that's not really what makes a cult. But it does mean that I think the occult community is maybe slightly more vulnerable to these kind of movements, as you were discussing. So it's something that's kind of salient for us to keep in mind, because those sort of high control systems can be things that we might fall into if we're not careful.
Yeah, Hanny put it so eloquently. I wanted to talk about it because I also am sort of obsessed with cults. If you're super interested in this topic, I am going to recommend there's a great podcast called Cults by the Parcast Network that I've listened to for a couple of years now that I think is really good. So But really, in this episode, we wanted to kind of explore the difference between cults and new religious movements, which are, like Hanny said, often associated with these high control groups, talk about some of the psychology behind cult membership, and then also discuss some of the warning signs to keep into consideration when a group may not be as brilliant as they seem. So let's kind of pull back a little bit and go all the way back to ancient Greece, where the word cult actually had a very different meaning. Thel, do you want to take that? Well, you both can, as our experts in this field.
Well, expert is a strong word.
Let me gas you up. Come on.
Yeah. All right. So cult comes from the Latin cultus, which literally just means worship. I have to have this conversation with so many people all the time that, like, when I'm talking about the cult of Artemis, I'm not talking about what we think of as a modern day cult surrounding the goddess Artemis, for example. So cults historically were just kind of like a group that was really focused around a particular god or deity. And then you start getting into mystery cults. Gotta mention Pythagoras here. He's in every episode. The Pythagoreans were a mystery cult, and one could see Pythagoras as its leader, but because he's more of like a mythological figure, like, I would not define him as a cult leader, TM. So mystery cults are mysterious naturally. They're secretive, so we don't always know about their beliefs, but they often had a vow of secrecy. It's hard to think of, like, when you think about, like, historical cults, because, again, certain things seem, like, culty, right? Like, the cult of Dionysus, especially in the Bacchae, where the Maenads are, like, ripping men to shreds. Obviously, that's kind of cult-like behavior, but it's mythologized, so, like, I would not say that that's an accurate thing to call a cult. And it's interesting that, like, cults don't really, and we're going to get into this, but, like, a lot of history around cults really starts in, like, the 20th century. And I think this is for a couple of different reasons. There was definitely, like, weird groups before, and, like, a lot of things, like Mormonism, for example, could have started as a cult, or even Shakerism was considered a cultish offshoot of the Quaker branch. But because when you're looking at history, right, those things are so much older, so we don't really look at them as what we would consider a modern day cult.
Sorry, I thought that Belle kind of already outlined that in the last that she said.
Okay, we can move on then. Do you want to go just ahead to start talking about some modern cult examples?
Yeah, I mean, I can add it. I'll just say it if you want, Belle can edit it out. Okay, by contrast, the modern definition of cult, while fuzzy, typically implies a level of structure of control, and modern cults aren't always strictly religious in nature like they were historically. As Belle mentioned, the term only took on darker undertones around the mid-20th century, but the definition is kind of fraught and under active debate, and sometimes we use that word high control group instead for this reason. So maybe if we can think of some modern cults to set the scene, to kind of give you an idea of the kinds of things we're thinking about. Are there any cults that you guys can think of that immediately come to mind when you say use that word?
Well, there's one that's really interesting that I learned about more recently, and that is an example of an older cult. And interestingly, a Catholic cult, which is not as common. They're called the Slaves of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And they were
specifically... They're always the Marian devotionals. I swear that, like, the Catholic cultists are always like Marian. I don't know what it is.
Which is so bizarre, because, like, what about Mary says, like, let's be weird, whatever. But this is interesting because this group is, like, near where I am. And another one of the cults that are founded by women, there's actually a lot of cults that are founded by women, you know, gender equality. So they did a lot of things like taking kids from their parents and kind of like raising people like specifically in like this weird school. I want to just flag them because they're much earlier. They're like the 1940s. And then you get to the really famous ones like Scientology, which actually is, I think, older than some people think it is.
One of my favorite cults is Nixium. I remember when that documentary came out and I was just so shocked at everything that happened. I think it was a really great example of a cult because you know how like everybody has that phrase, right? That I would never get drawn into a cult. But like truthfully, everybody is capable of that if the right conditions are present. And I think Nexium is really one of the more kind of modern cults that speaks to the dangers of things like self-help and personal growth and how those can be used in like really negative ways that actually can draw people into something that's much darker and more egregious. So skip forward a little bit, like 30 seconds if you don't want to hear some of the details I'm about to tell you. But basically, Nexium presented itself as a company that was selling these self-improvement like courses. But they actually engaged in very abusive practices like forced labor. They deprived their members of sleep. There was extreme dedication to the leaders, so much so that there was like a secret group of women who actually went through a branding ritual and had the leaders like initials branded on their bodies, which is crazy. And so kind of from that perspective, like Nexium is a really good example about how cults are sometimes more about active practice than they are about a particular belief. So the cult did make extreme claims about the leader. So, you know, he was a polymath. He was really smart. He was very charismatic, all of these things, very calm, very level-headed, so on and so forth. But what really made it a cult was the high-control nature of that particular group. Especially the women in that kind of close-knit circle, right? They had sort of like a master-slave relationship, and the slave couldn't do anything without the permission of the master and so on and so forth. And so it was extremely high control, especially the deeper you went into the cult. And I found that whole, not only the way they got people to enter into the group fascinating, but then how extreme it became the further into the hold of the leader you got.
Yeah, I think the archetypal examples I can think of are definitely Scientology, which I could go on and on about. I probably shouldn't. But yeah, that's another interesting one because it sort of evolved initially from ideas around self-help like Nexium did, but then it sort of evolved its own mythology because the guy who founded it was actually a science fiction writer. And so a lot of the stuff that comes up actually seems to be from his writings. And it's been described as a cult by lots of ex-members because the auditing practice that they perform, which is part of your progression through Scientology, has been described as emotionally manipulative. There's a lot of financial pressure to progress, and there's also a lot of harassment of ex-members. So if you speak out, you're often condemned by the group and sometimes even followed around. Some of the more horrible examples, I think that a lot of people would think of when they can think of cults, and again, maybe skip ahead a little bit to these, but they're those with the most tragic consequences. So Jonestown and Heaven's Gate are two examples of those. They were arguably quite different in structure, but both of them were similar in that they led to the mass suicides of their members. So Jim Jones, in the case of Jonestown, coerced his followers into what he called revolutionary suicide because he was paranoid that the US government were kind of closing in on his commune. Whereas in Heaven's Gate, individuals in the cult were concerned that planet Earth was going to be recycled, and so they had to leave their human bodies behind. So both circumstances were kind of tragic and they both have charismatic leaders, but you can see that the beliefs involved are quite different and the structures are quite different. So it's kind of interesting. It shows you how diverse cults can be while maintaining a lot of the same mechanisms, I guess.
Yeah, all really good examples, ones that hopefully people are kind of familiar with. But so I think like next, we should talk about how we can then define cults in like the modern sense of the word. And then how do we differentiate like cults from new religious movements? What are kind of the distinctions there? So as mentioned previously, cults are really hard to define. And the term has been criticized over the years for being insufficiently specific. prior definitions often lean into the ideas of cults being defined by like deviant beliefs. So Stark and Bainbridge's famous religious marketplace theory describes cults as existing in tension with the dominant sociocultural religious institution. So in modern day, that would typically be some form of Christianity, usually, or an Abrahamic religion of some kind, at least in the West. That is certainly different in the East. But this feels sort of like broad and generally unsatisfying, because for one, there's a harmless nature to a lot of new religious movements, and they would still fall under that condition because they are considered quote unquote deviant to the popular religion, at least in the West. So something even like Thelema, for example, could be considered unusual. And if you don't know this, Thelema actually had connections to Scientology back in the day through Jack Parsons, who I think we have an episode on, maybe. We might have taken that down.
We deleted that episode. Yes.
Okay. But anyways, but like, would you consider Thelema to be a cult? I mean, I certainly wouldn't. Like, I know Thelemites, they were like good people, and its inner workings like aren't a cult in my opinion. But as we kind of touched upon earlier with those other examples, cultic beliefs aren't always necessarily extreme or even religious in nature. So do you think that conventional or like deviant beliefs are a necessary part of the cult definition? And really, should it even be considered part of it at all? What do you guys think?
I mean, I definitely don't think it should be part of the definition. I would say like cults obviously do have unconventional beliefs, even the ones that are seemingly more mainstream, but they're not cults because they're unconventional. They're unconventional because of what they do and how the group operates. But I don't think unconventional, that's just so silly, because it's like, once you start, I hate the word deviant. Once people start throwing the word deviant around, I'm like, this person's just a, like, that's just such like a, like hegemony, hegemonic, is that? Whatever, such like a word that's used to like shame anyone who's like not a part of the status quo. So it's just like so stupid. Like, deviant is also the word that people use when people are like, oh, the queer community is a cult, which like obviously that doesn't make any sense from any stretch of the word, but because of those definitions, I think they're actually end up almost being more dangerous than helpful.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that sometimes cults are associated with those kind of deviant beliefs, in that those beliefs can be what sort of hooks someone in, if that makes sense. So, I mean, often somebody who is slightly more vulnerable to a cult might be kind of seeking some kind of ideological fulfillment. And so they might sort of seek out a particularly heterodox group because that is kind of what they're looking for. And I think that maybe partly explains why people are kind of drawn into these like networks with really high social cohesion. But yeah, to me, the part that is cultic is more the structure of control, which we'll kind of get into a bit later. Some researchers have used the term destructive cult.
Can I say something?
Yeah, of course you can.
I think the other thing, reason I don't like the word deviant or anything that is heterodox to like the current orthodoxy, is that it provides an opportunity for people to be discriminatory, like substantially, actually. Because, for example, we see a lot of times, especially in the West, and I have some friends who are a part of Eastern traditions, and it's been interesting, especially in the kind of last couple of years, how many like Eastern kind of Buddhist like spiritual groups or new religious movements have been labeled as cults. And certainly I think some of them have some like questionable things that have happened like that deserve perhaps more investigation. But oftentimes it's just because it's something that's different, or it's something that seems deviant, or it's something that is just so contrary to what we consider to be normal or socially acceptable. And it leads to this discrimination just automatically by nature of it being not Western, right? And I think that is also a big problem when it comes to using the whole deviant thing in that labeling. But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's fine. So some researchers have decided that they will instead use the term destructive cult so they can differentiate it from new religious movements. But this has also kind of been criticized in that it's kind of redundant, right? And it also might somehow imply that new religious movements themselves are destructive. So it doesn't really solve the problem that's involved. Like, what do you think about this term? Do you think it's useful? I think that cult itself kind of implies a dangerousness, and we don't need that extra terminology, just myself.
In a lot of ways, yeah. I think that like using the word destructive in front of it, so it puts more emphasis on the harm that cults often perpetuate. But like you said, I feel like that's already a part of the terminology. Like, what makes it a cult? It's that it causes harm to the individual and frankly to larger communities. So it seems redundant to me.
Yeah. For me, it's like I personally prefer the term high control group for reasons I'll touch on later. But it's one of those things, right? Like when I made my Discord cults video, even though I personally think the term high control group is more descriptive and more helpful, I use the term cult in the title because it's a term that everyone knows. So I think you also run into that issue of like when you're using a word or using descriptions and definitions, it's like, you're right, it's like destructive cult is just, as you said, like redundant. And it's kind of more on the onus of the person using the word to clarify what they mean. And it's more important to get the point across than to like beat yourself up over semantics.
Well, you touched upon a good point, which is that the descriptor itself is too subjective for there to be any measurable quality by which we label something as destructive. So like, what is the point kind of on the spectrum where you say, oh, I've passed the point where I think this is okay, and now we've moved into destructive territory? I mean, that can be different for everybody. And so it's even hard then to label anything as destructive if it's entirely based on the individual subjectivity.
It's like, oh yeah, they're in a cult. Oh, don't worry, it's fine. Like, no one is gonna, like, I did watch this video of like someone who started a cult for friends, but like she was just a weirdo. And it's, yeah, at that point it's like, no. No one generally is gonna mistake you for thinking something good when you're talking about cult, which like is fine, I think, because most modern groups don't describe themselves willingly as cults.
Another thing that I think is really important when we're thinking about this whole deviancy thing is we need to think about the actual social context. So, Astra, you kind of alluded to this idea that when we're thinking about cults, like in our society, we're often thinking in opposition to like the hegemony of Christianity, for example. But obviously the social context can define what is seen as deviant belief. And so those incumbent social norms inform how societies respond to new religious movements. This can backfire because it means that repressive governments might use the term cult to limit the freedoms of harmless movements. Falun Gong, which is a Chinese religious movement, is an interesting example. So the Chinese government has described this group as Jizhao, which is evil cult. I'm pretty sure I got the tone wrong there. but it means that this has meant that Falun Gong members have been subject to repressive action, including mass imprisonments and even supposedly torture. So while some ex-members of the group have described practices which might be considered cult-like, like fervent devotion and ideas of supernatural powers on the part of their leader, scholarly debate on the issue is not settled. And because the Chinese government is kind of opposed to beliefs which do not fit in with their idea of like social cohesion and what acceptable religion is, this biases how they're able to define cults. So there's kind of a dialogue here between like normalcy and between actual belief. And we need to, I think, be a bit more careful when we consider the behaviors when we're actually defining a cult.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree with that. So kind of based on that point, what are some common features that we see in cults, even just like across the world, not just thinking in like the Western sphere? What are kind of some common themes that exist between them?
I think the number one that people think of is a charismatic leader who has a great power of personal control over members. So they often kind of, you know, they have fantastical abilities ascribed to them, like in the Mother God cult, where like literally she was God. Questioning the leader is not allowed. the leader is the primary authority, and it's usually hierarchical. I will say, I think we're going to get into the bite model, but I think sometimes people say it can't be a cult unless it has a charismatic leader. I feel like there's definitely cases where you can have a cult that is a group of people, or even just like a really strong mindset. Or in the cases where the leader dies, they can still be a cult. Anyway.
Oh, sorry, this is way off topic, but did you guys see that thing about the kind of really, really hardcore Orthodox Jewish sect who tunneled under the because their leader had like died, and they believed he was going to be resurrected, and so they had this like such a strong belief they actually tunneled under to create room for him. That is kind of a good example, I think, maybe we shouldn't include this, but of what you're describing, where the belief in the leader goes like beyond their death, beyond what they're saying. It just goes into like this like kind of group thing sort of thing.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre. I mean, one could even say that happened with Mormonism too, right? In Scientology, but anyway.
So another one, I guess, which is really common, are fears around the outside world. So there's this kind of world within the cult, which is considered safe, and then the outside world might be considered dangerous, persecutory. There's a sort of us versus them idea, and so the cult is promoted as the only place of safety. And often this means that individuals within the cult will be isolated from their family members, from their loved ones, and even relationships within the cult might be disrupted, which means that the individual will end up relying on the cult itself for information and for emotional support, and it makes it actually harder for them to get out. And similarly, you'll see that information is often controlled as well. So because the outside world is seen as dangerous, media, which might kind of promote any kind of thinking outside of it, is restricted.
I think this is something that is really popular within like religious cults specifically, is this idea that like the outside world is evil and will like pull you away from whatever like religious promises or like rules you're following. I'm thinking specifically of like the FLDS. I was watching what is it, Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey, fairly recently. Again, I watched it the first time a while ago. And just like the way in which these people were so terrified of doing anything against, like, of interacting with anybody on the outside, because it would like poison their minds against God. And that's always like a very concerning thing. But I think it can also be much more subtle. It can be much more nuanced. It can be someone telling you that, you know, you need to separate yourself from like a family member because they're not good for you. They're holding you back. They're causing you to be low vibrational, right? Like those are also things to look out for. They're more subtle and they're kind of presented in a way of like, you know, you need to remove this person from your life because they're holding you back. But that just leads to that further isolation. And it can be kind of the first starting steps of entering into a cult. So just kind of things to keep in mind. Another big one is this loss of identity, of individual identity, and your ability to make decisions. So the whole concept of like this uncritical obedience, this obedience no matter what, even when it contradicts your experience or the needs of somebody else, that is also a red flag. So behavior can be ego dystonic, so stretching to cruelty even to other members, even if there's not like a good reason to, but because you were just told to do so. Or you were told that somebody is bad or evil, and because, you know, someone told you that, like, there's no critical consideration of the evidence, and it's just you accept it as fact. Invoking these kind of thought-terminating cliches and other language that shuts down those kind of inquiries. And then trauma. I mean, every cult forces people through traumatic experiences, right? And this can lead to decision paralysis on the actual individual and just kind of automatic deference to the leader. So, you know, people going through acts of extreme violence, fears of the outside world, like we talked about before, practices that alter states of consciousness. So, you know, in ritual, we do things like fasting and kind of reducing our sleep to help us get into those states. Well, they can also be used for nefarious purposes, right? And so in this case, those things make people more susceptible to your suggestion. And then you can also, you know, dissociate from your own experiences. And this also kind of reduces your ability to think clearly and prioritize your own needs over that of the commune or the community. And then, you know, this relational enmeshment. So the idea, kind of like something Hanny was talking about earlier, where it's less about you as the individual and more about the community as a whole. So your self-esteem, your self-importance, it becomes intrinsically linked to the group belonging. And so, and you're almost punished if you start to think that any of your needs are more important than the group as a whole. And so that loss of identity is a really big component there in most cults. Who wants to talk about doomsday cults? You get the fun one.
I can take either one, really. I can take it.
I'll take them. Okay. So there's millenarian. I literally had it perfectly in my head. Okay. Millenarianism, which are doomsday cults. So it's also important to note, not every cult is a doomsday cult, but there are obviously doomsday cults are like the easiest examples when people think of cults. So it's basically they have an eschatological belief around the upcoming end of the world. So there's an end of days. So this isn't obviously exclusive to cults. I mean, within Christianity, eschatology is a form of study. There's also like newer forms of Christianity that are like more obsessed with it, like evangelicals. Although one could say that a lot of evangelicals are culty, as are Pentecostals. Again, there's a lot of people consider sub Pentecostal groups to be cultists. And then the new apostolics. Again, all of these, I think, wildly, the sect as a whole might not be a cult. I think there are often cults within those particular sects. So for the example, they're not always Christian, like Heaven's Gate, where the planet Earth is being recycled and Halley's Comet and all of that. And then Charles Manson, who deserves very little time, he didn't necessarily believe in an end of the world, but that there would be upcoming like race war, which he's a horrible dude. Again, don't want to give him much airtime. So it's oftentimes, though, like doomsday cults don't stick around. Just by the very nature of them, they kind of have an endpoint, and they are very much like the big bads. All cults are bad, but these ones are the ones that often end in violence. So they are quite extreme. Also, I will say not all doomsday cults start as doomsday cults. Like in the case of the People's Temple, they started out as a culty sect, and then they moved to Jonestown, where they became more doomsday. So that's always something to watch out for, is that they might turn into doomsday cults.
I was going to say, something that I find really interesting about doomsday cults is that quite often you'll find that the leader will predict an end of the world. Obviously, the world has not ended yet, to my knowledge. So, but the leaders are so preoccupied with this that they will kind of use that as like a test for the obedience of the followers. So even when presented with the fact like, oh, the world's going to end in this many days, the world does not end. The members of the cult do not always leave because they are so ideologically committed that they're willing to overlook everything in their actual experience. And I think that to me like really sums up how strong the level of cult control is, because they're willing to see somebody be wrong again and again and again, but still believe wholeheartedly in the cult itself.
I I think it's also really easy for people to convince themselves that this is a thing, right? So there's actually an example of somebody, his name's Harold Camping, and he was a Christian radio broadcaster who actually used gematria to as like the key element behind his doomsday predictions, right? And so when he was camping, he claimed to essentially have found hidden codes in the Bible, which is like gematria at its core, revealing the time of the rapture and the end of the world. This was like, I think, roughly in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so even like from kind of an occult perspective, right, we have methods that are often used within kind of our practices, taken and twisted a little bit to then lead to the creation of this idea of like a doomsday, in which everybody needs to prepare for and all that stuff. So this is why it's important to stay grounded and make sure you actually understand why we're doing certain things that we're doing.
So the other example, I think, which is maybe a little bit more controversial, but that I think really explains cults quite well, is the idea of cults as like mini totalitarian systems. So just personally, like, I'm not an expert, but I sort of see a spectrum from abusive relationships to cults all the way to like large totalitarian regimes. Because to me, they sort of share these similar principles where you've got a central locus of control, you've got the safety or supremacy of the abusive system, whether that's an abusive person or whether that's, you know, a government, and everywhere else is not safe, and like a loss of individual identity in favor of the decisions of the abusive system, whatever that might be. And so it's coercive control, like all the way down. And there are even some situations like the Lambeth slavery case, which is quite disturbing, just to warn you, but where it's a family situation, but it's also a cult. So there's kind of a bit of a dialogue between those two things. It's not always a clear boundary. And so this in this. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you finish your thought.
I was going to say there's a lot of the systems you'll see within cults as well, with like internal surveillance, so like members spying on each other, you'll also see within totalitarian systems. So there's also kind of parallels in the mechanisms that they use.
And I think that's a definitely, that makes sense to see them as mini totalitarian systems. I mean, even the study of cults started, at least in the United States, with in the 50s, with those who were prisoners of war in Korean prisoners of war camp. Like, that's literally where we get a lot of studies and definitions of things for cults. So it makes a lot of sense that they would be mini authoritarianism, because they come, a lot of the studies come from like totalitarian regimes.
Yeah, there's a guy called Robert Lifton, and he's a bit controversial, but he was initially a researcher in like war crimes, things like that. And so he was the one who applied this doctrine of totalism. And that, as you say, that was taken from studying things like war, and it was applied to cults because in theory, some of those psychological systems are sort of the same. But I guess it's also interesting to point out that the amount of authoritarianism might differ a little bit. So like Heaven's Gate was sort of weird in that it didn't have the same kind of like threats of violence against members. They were in theory free to leave, but they did have things like isolating members and changing their names and their physical appearance and all those things, which would, although it doesn't look like classic authoritarianism, it still promotes like group adhesion over sort of societal adhesion, if that makes sense. So you can kind of define it in different ways.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, again, like talking about what a cult is, that definition is so fuzzy. And I think it's important to just mention that these examples aren't perfect. And there's likely exceptions to everything that we're putting out there, but like generally these are all kind of examples to help like share our points and kind of explain where we're coming from. But when we talk about cults, there's a particular model that comes up more often than really anything else, and it's a more academic model, but there's sort of a divide between those associated with this anti-cult movement and those who are more pro-religion, and they don't agree on the complete use of this particular model, particularly because it doesn't have really any academic backing in the sense that it was peer-reviewed by people in the community. So the BITE framework, or the BITE model is commonly known, was developed by Stephen Hassan, who is a prolific, although somewhat controversial, figure in the field of cult research. Hassan has been criticized for his early involvement in cult deprogramming, more on that later, as well as his rather general definition of that which constitutes a cult. His affiliation with members of the controversial anti-cult movement has generated some antipathy toward his views. But that being said, the model has gained a lot of popularity online since its publication in 2021, so it's worth mentioning. So in the next kind of section, we're going to talk about the BITE model or the BITE framework, kind of break it down a little bit, give you some examples, and then also talk about its application to social media. Someone else go. I feel like we need to instigate a hand-holding thing. Like, if you're going to talk, put your hand up.
Okay, so the BITE framework is based around this idea that of excessive control in four spheres of life. So that's behavior, emotion, information, and thought. There's too many examples for each one, but I'll just kind of pick a few just to give it examples. Examples of behavioral control might be regulating someone's diet, manipulating their sleep. It might be more extreme, so kidnapping or torture, things like that. Imposition of rigid rules and regulations. Information control, we already kind of talked about, non-cultic material is not allowed, so the information is withheld, and also information is controlled, so other members kind of spy on one another. They may produce propaganda which promotes the cult's tactics, and they might also use confession to kind of manipulate information about a member and turn it back on them. Thought control would be things like changing someone's name and identity, using particular language like thought terminating cliches, which you talked about, encouraging only good and proper thoughts. There's mentions of hypnosis in here, which we'll kind of get to. And then emotional control, whereas individuals are kind of encouraged to internalize anything negative as their own fault, feel kind of guilty and unworthy because this kind of reduces their self-esteem, and therefore their self-esteem is related to the cult. And they may kind of go through emotional highs and lows, and that again is a really useful control tactic because the highs can be kind of attributed to the cult, whereas the lows can be attributed to the individual, and it again promotes a kind of dependency. And there's like way, way more than that, but those are just like a few examples to give you a flavor of what the BITE model is about.
I'm curious, this model has sort of come under scrutiny over the last like couple of years that it's been out. What do you guys think about its accuracy in using it to help determine whether or not a group is a cult?
Huh. I mean, I found it useful for myself when I was leaving the high demand group I was a part of, because all the other definitions were like, they have to have this like charisma, they had to have like all these rigid things. So I think it's helpful in expanding the definition of cult, but I think it can easily become like almost too expansive, if that makes sense. Like, I mean, there's one of those things, I don't think there's ever going to be a perfect definition for cult, but I think it is helpful in identifying like toxic behaviors in a group.
Yeah, confession to make, I used to really, really love the BITE model, and I would like talk about it to everyone, like, yeah, this is a really useful useful framework for understanding cults. And then I kind of looked into it a bit more, and I realized that it doesn't actually have the kind of academic backing that I thought it did. And also there's a lot of controversy associated with Stephen Hassan, who is the guy who actually came up with it. So I do think there's some merit to it. Like some of the proposals in there, obviously I couldn't go through all of them, but like some of them make sense. You know, discouraging individualism, manipulating how much sleep someone can get, and minimizing information. Those all kind of track with ideas of cults that we can identify. But then there are things that don't apply to every cult. There are things like hypnosis, which we know as kind of based on really outdated science about cults. And some of these things could just apply to regular religions. Like, yeah, control over diet is a problem if somebody is being forced to fast and it's being done in order to, you know, make somebody more susceptible. But lots of religions have fasting, right? So then it becomes a little bit too general. And I think maybe that's the reason it doesn't have as much academic backing, because it's not very easy to make formal definitions and falsify things with.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. I think that the BITE model is a useful means by which to kind of measure any group and sort of suss out potential red flags. But in much like what Hanny was saying, I think you'll rarely find all aspects of the BITE model within a single group. And so it's sort of, again, this like personal metric of what are you willing to accept as like not a problem, but how much accumulation does it take in order for you to see the red flags and call something a cult? The other issue with the BITE model, and this was so interesting because I came across a thesis when we were researching for this episode, and there was somebody who talks about how the BITE model is just a little bit outdated when it comes to the online community. So I thought that was interesting, and I wanted to talk about it because really, like, I mean, Phil was talking about earlier, right? Social media mini cults are all over the place. And when we talk about the BITE model, we often think about cults within like real life, because that's what everybody is like more familiar with. But there are aspects of it in social media that I think it's important to sort of bring up. So we're going to look at the BITE model in respect to social media. Now, the large social media companies, think Facebook and Google and Instagram, which is run by Facebook, I suppose, TikTok and Twitter, or now X, they focus on creating content that is really emotionally impactful. And this is done in such a way that it stimulates users in both a hormonal and a subconscious way that creates this compulsion loop. Now, this compulsion loop works sort of as a variable rate reinforcement, which basically means that rewards are delivered in an unpredictable fashion that leaves you, as the kids would say it, quote unquote, chasing the likes, right? And this symptom of internet addiction really comes about from a literal change, like in our emotions and these neural connections. And the speed at which it happens is frankly terrifying. It is really easy for us to make new neural connections. And I think when we talk about, you know, short attention spans and all of that being attributed to social media, like this is one of the reasons why. And in our current climate, especially, it's really easy to see how social media can be used for information control. So these dominant companies, among other media sources, of course, are often very biased in their reporting. They're pushing content in the direction of specific ideas, movements, or stories they want to support. But it's important to consider how this is influential in the other direction. An uncontrolled spread of misinformation because of the absence of any overarching regulatory authority can also be a problem. I think a kind of a fun, quirky example that was given in the thesis was that of the hashtag. So if you think about when you add a hashtag to a post, it's both a searchable index entry and it's also serving as a slogan. So when you use it, you're connecting yourself with other people who have the same interests and beliefs. And if you use it often enough, it creates an echo chamber that keeps sort of this quote unquote undesirable information outside of the community of that particular hashtag. And so it's easy to kind of insert yourself accidentally into this echo chamber that could potentially become something more. But there was also, speaking on totalitarianism, is that the word? Sorry, my mind went blank. There's another aspect of this which kind of goes along with the authoritarianism that we were talking about earlier. And they posited an interesting idea about how thought control with the idea that social media is both compatible with authoritarianism and that it's one of the main reasons why authoritarian practices are kind of growing in popularity. So kind of going back to the basics of what authoritarianism is, those practices aim to control people and sow confusion, ignorance, prejudice, chaos, all things kind of to undermine public accountability. And so within social media, it can look really simple. Short posts with little nuance designed to be extreme, divisive, and emotionally charged. Hot takes, for example. But it feeds into this information control above, in that it helps users be exposed to content that aligns with their opinions. And it can lead to takes on potentially incorrect information that are due either to a lack of time to research the claims, or, as I think what happens more frequently, when people do have the time, those falsehoods or that misinformation has kind of already been embedded, and they don't feel the need to actually do the further research to confirm what they think. But what do you all think about that? Kind of putting the BITE model in a social media framework.
It's definitely interesting. I mean, obviously, certain things are harder to control, right? Like controlling someone's sleep is much easier when you're in a physical presence versus online. But I mean, I honestly, ever since I left a high demand group, when I started going to college, I noticed it was rampant on social media. Like, that was the first thing that I noticed. I was like, how does no one else see how culty all of these seemingly innocuous groups are? Like, even amongst like, leftists are not immune to this behavior whatsoever. And like, I would see people just like tearing each other apart and like being like, oh, you can't think like that. And I just remember, this was back in 2014, so like a lot has changed since then. But I remember like feeling that way, like when I got out of a high demand group, I was like, I feel like I'm just walking into another one that's like weirder and way more integrated in online. Yeah, so I definitely think it has, I don't think like all the internet is a cult, but I think there can be cult like behavior amongst groups on the internet, even if they are not like religiously backed.
Yeah, I have kind of conflicted opinions on this, because I think there's some validity to it. Like, the internet is definitely being used as sort of a recruitment ground for cults. It's actually interesting, like Heaven's Gate, this was back in the 90s, and they were one of the earliest groups to actually use the internet. And it's very creepy, but some of the members are actually still maintaining their website as it was back in the 90s.
One guy.
Yeah, it's unsettling, to say the least. Like, you can see the videos from members who have since passed and things. It's very unsettling. And so, like, this has evolved. So not everybody would define Islamic State as a cult, but some researchers have, and I'll put a thing in the bibliography to justify that. But Islamic State actually use online recruitment as a major method for gaining new members, because they can essentially groom and use this concerted disinformation and like psychological pressure in order to recruit new members into their extreme belief system. So in that sense, I do think that misinformation and disinformation can contribute, but I don't know that I agree that things like hashtags themselves act as cultic devices, because I think like there's still a semblance of disagreement that you might see within that sphere. And also, the locus of control isn't always clear. So it's not like there's a centralized place from which this misinformation is coming. A lot of the time it kind of arises in maybe less predictable ways, and some of it is somewhat organic. So I don't think it's a direct allegory to cults where the locus of control is like quite well defined and it comes from an individual. The internet is a little bit, yes, there are like malevolent forces, I would say, at work, but like it's a little bit more nuanced than that, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. I think it's harder to establish like very strict kind of guidelines or definitions on like what this looks like on the internet, because there's so many, like it's constantly moving and changing. And I also think in relation to kind of being online, it's easier for somebody to kind of avoid thought control by nature of the fact that they have the internet, right? Like, this is both a blessing and a curse, in the sense where you could see a bunch of things, but also it would be easier to kind of snap out of it if you saw like an article, for example, that countered the very thing that you were, you know, like falling for example. So it's not perfect, but I just thought it was interesting, that whole thesis. And I'll include it in the show notes below so people can read it and kind of decide for yourself what you think. But it had brought up a lot of really interesting points that really made me think. So we've kind of talked about cults. We've tried to define it. I don't know how successful we've been at that. We've talked about various kinds of cults, common themes within them. We talked about the bite model. So let's move on to talking about how do we deal with these high control groups and people who might be involved. What are the ways to engage without, you know, being mean and cruel?
So maybe before we talk about how to deal with them, we should talk about how to not deal with them, yep. Which then involves getting into the, kind of the history of the anti-cult movement, which we mentioned earlier. So we'll kind of contextualize, like, much of the older research on cults is led by the anti-cult movement of the 1940s onwards. And this group has historically been dominated by evangelical Protestants and often tends to classify all new religious movements as cults because they're heterodox, as we kind of discussed before, this idea of like deviancy. And you can see like the satanic panic and things like that, other moral panics sort of mirror and reinforce this kind of thinking, where any religious views or even non-religious behaviors like Dungeons and Dragons are perceived as kind of deviant to the norm, and they're threatening, they're dangerous, and they're cults. But obviously dangerous cults do exist, but we need to bear in mind that the anti-cult movement does not always make that distinction. So one key piece of messaging from the anti-cult movement that you hear about a lot is this idea of brainwashing, and how in order to overcome a cult, you must overcome the brainwashing that you are subject to. But does brainwashing really exist? I want to ask you first, like, how would you define brainwashing? Or like, what is your understanding of like that popular culture?
I guess when I would think of, I mean, I don't really fully believe in it, but when you're thinking about brainwashing, I think it goes back to like those thought stopping cliches where like, even if someone, like, you're just in so deep that everything in your brain wants to fight for you to stay in that belief, because breaking that belief is scary. So I think in a way that could be what brainwashing is seen as, or is.
I don't know that brainwashing is a term that I would use for this so much as I would use the term indoctrination. And I think they're different things. Brainwashing implies that you sort of lose all sense of personal thought, personal identity, when I think indoctrination is more of a consistent reminder that like whatever you're being told is the right answer. So it's not necessarily removing like your individual thought, but it's just kind of reinforcing a particular thing over and over again, whereas that's the first thing that pops into your head, right? Instead of maybe what your individual thought is. And this gets into like even things like bias, right? We all have kind of the first thought that comes into your head when you see something. But then if you take a second and actually think about it, kind of the other thought that you haven't been indoctrinated with will come to the forefront. So I think that indoctrination is really more of the problem than brainwashing specifically, but I'm also, I feel like, being sort of semantical, so we can move on.
No, I mean, I think these are really good because these are sort of more nuanced definitions than the kind of popular idea of brainwashing as it is. So it's kind of vague, but the anti-cult movement has sort of wielded it as this like irresistible hypnotic tool which turns individuals into like unthinking zombies. So there are scholars like Abgral and Singer, and they may actually explicitly argue for the use of hypnosis in cults, which we know probably doesn't work. And it's the idea of like something which is kind of impossible to overcome. And so it's kind of come up quite a lot in academic history from a few angles because of this idea of totalitarianism. So brainwashing in this case would not only be relevant to cults, but it might also be relevant to regimes like Nazism and Stalinism. And so some people might argue that brainwashing is a reason for collusion with these regimes. But the problem with that is that it obviously shifts the responsibility from the individual onto the regime. and it kind of reduces their autonomy. So we kind of know, like, it's not the best way of describing things. Early psychological studies did suggest a level of deference to authority. So if you guys are familiar with the Milgram experiment, it's a pretty horrible one. It's where the participants were instructed to administer electric shocks to other participants when they were instructed to. And even when they could see that the person they were shocking was in pain, was in distress, they kept doing it because they were, in theory, deferential to authority. Obviously, we don't do these experiments these days because they're very unethical, but they kind of point to the idea that social pressures can kind of force this conformity. And we also know that cult survivors have sometimes described themselves as being brainwashed. So there is some water to it. And one other thing Fel mentioned earlier, like the specific term brainwashing did actually come from studies in the 50s of like prisoners of war, for example, actually by the CIA, they were trying to provide an explanation for why some prisoners of war converted to communism, because I guess for them, during that time period, the Red Scare was very prevalent. Like, there couldn't possibly be another explanation for why, you know, somebody would become a communist other than brainwashing. So they kind of had a vested interest in that. But yeah, we'll kind of get into, like, yeah, this is popular with the anti-cult movement because you can shift the blame from the individual onto the cult. And you can say this heterodox movement is really dangerous because it can cause you to do all these evil things. And if you're a very extreme evangelical Protestant, who wants to delegitimize a new religious movement, that's really attractive, right? But I don't know that this is accurate, and maybe we can talk about why that is a bit oversimplified.
I feel like you talked about anti-brainwashing too. Am I missing something?
I didn't kind of talk about like the high turnover, the fact the CIA just kind of disproved it. Like,
okay, yeah, I'll start there. Okay. So kind of on the opposite spectrum of pro-brainwashing, we have anti-brainwashing. And this, in the sense of like a hypnotic force, sort of, that takes over a person's free will. But this is oversimplified for a couple of reasons. The first is that it's based on behaviorism, which is an outdated psychological theory, maintaining that all learning results from external influence or this conditioning. As kind of Hanny was saying, at its most extreme, really behaviorism denies free will, which is not congruent with other studies on obedience, but it also alludes to hypnosis as a methodology. And if you listen to our hypnosis episode, it can change behavior under certain circumstances, but it requires really specific circumstances to do that. And it doesn't necessarily act against an individual's quote unquote free will. So the other thing to think about when it comes to anti-brainwashing is the high turnover of cults. A surprising number of new cultic recruits actually don't join, which runs counter to this idea that brainwashing is this like all-powerful force. The brain bridge shift occurs after about 2 to 3 years, which suggests that individuals form an initial bond with a group, after which the control mechanisms might be more important. So there are several high-profile cases, one of which is that of Patricia Hearst, kidnapping and robbery. And this included some testimonies from psychologists like Singer on brainwashing that was later thrown out by the court on account of a lack of broad scientific support. But perhaps more crucially, because there are so many models of brainwashing, the theory itself is really difficult to falsify. And this means that scholars are quite divided on the topic, and there's a lot of reticence to use the particular term brainwashing. That I think it also just has a very negative connotation that sometimes is quite unhelpful when it comes up in various court hearings and everything like that.
Okay, so that being said, while brainwashing overstates kind of the loss of autonomy and is kind of like a CIA boogeyman word, there are tactics that cults imply that diminish the individual identity and your ability to make decisions. So this would be things like reducing the amount of sleep or food we get. We kind of talked about that with behavioral, isolating them from support systems like their family, imposing this idea that the outside world is inherently bad, removing traditional family structures, So this could be like literally taking you away from your parents or having you just like kind of dissolving that structure. Name changes and then denigration and shaming. So all of these lead to a loss of sense of self, and there's this uncertainty, and it makes you rely on the group, especially if there's a charismatic leader. And then it also adds to the mistrust of outsiders. So even if brainwashing is not strictly true, it's definitely difficult for people within a cult affiliated group to extricate themselves from these behaviors. I mean, just even looking when people look at abusive relationships as well, there's many similarities there. It's also worth noting that there are certain things like love bombing, which for a while when I left my high demand group, love bombing was not a word that people had heard of, and now it's like a huge hot word that people use. But it's basically what it sounds like, where you overwhelm someone with love and it enhances social cohesion and again makes you reliant on the group. So it makes you feel that there's only safety in the group, even if ultimately the group is the one that's actually causing the harm.
I think the love bombing is a really important aspect of this because, so story time. before I converted to Catholicism, I, like when I was still going to graduate school at the local college campus, there was a church group that a friend invited me to. And I remember going, like looking back on it, I can recognize it better now. But I went and like the very first thing that happened was love bombing for like the first month. It was just consistent yep. love bombing. You're amazing. You're so smart. I mean, all of the classic stuff, right? And I remember feeling really disjointed and disoriented a little bit because I kept asking questions, of course, like asking questions. They're like, oh, no, we don't talk about those things, or like, you don't have to worry about that right now. Like a lot of that kind of discussion. And it really began to throw up some red flags. And I distinctly remember I began to look this place, this like church up online. And I found so many websites that were like, this group is a cult. And it was so innocuous. Like, it's a college campus group, easily pulled in, lots of love bombing, especially on college campuses, right, where students are sometimes going through depression and anxiety, you know, far away from home, and you just want a community of some kind. It can be so dangerous. Like, it even pulled me in, and I consider myself a fairly skeptical person. It can be a very kind of efficient way to draw people into a cult.
I think it's also important to note, like, with these cult-like behaviors, especially when they're done by members within the cult, they are not always intentionally malicious, which does not, you know, negate their harm. I remember that was really hard for me because I had actually done a lot of these behaviors to other people. So there's this lot of sense of like guilt for doing those things. And then also it makes you feel confusion at people who did those things to you, because you're like, I love you as a person, but like you did these things to me, but I know that you weren't aware of that. It's very interesting how people will subconsciously perpetuate these ideas, even if they don't actually know why they're doing them. And love bombing, I think, is a good example of that. Like, most people, if you were like, oh, you're love bombing, they wouldn't really recognize it as intentionally harmful because it's just what everyone around them is doing.
So far, I think it's a better explanation than brainwashing, which is just this like singular idea of a sort of hypnotic spell. It's better understood as kind of like a balance of how somebody controls emotions. Like, you think about this Bainbridge shift, where most people who meet a cult, they don't join up, but a certain number of people will, and those people are the people who stay. So a lot of those people who come into the cult or who are being love bombed, or, you know, they're maybe seeking something spiritually, they feel positive when they join because they're feeling loved or ideologically fulfilled. And that's what gets them to stay initially. And then you get the kind of controlling coercive measures later, which sort of maintain their influence. So it's kind of, it's not just one thing, but it's a system of factors. And all of these are kind of concerning. Like, I don't think we can reduce it to one or the other. Cool. So, anti-cult movements focused extensively on deprogramming individuals, which sometimes even extended to kidnapping them, forcibly trying to change their outlook. In sort of a darkly ironic twist, in the 1970s, the idea of deprogramming sometimes involved the very tactics that destructive cults themselves employ, such as food or sleep deprivation, or even worse, abuse. As you might imagine, this was often described as traumatic by those who experienced it, and it rarely yielded positive results. Today, deprogramming is widely dismissed as pseudoscientific and harmful to victims of high control groups. And in fact, psychologically, we have something called the backfire effect, which is kind of similar to the idea of cognitive dissonance, which is where when you're corrected for something very overtly, it might actually push an individual towards the belief instead of away from it. So sometimes directly confronting somebody is not productive, and it can reinforce this idea of us versus them if someone's been stuck in a belief system for a while. So, social psychologist Dr. Alexander Stein has instead described a three-step model to approach victims of high-control groups, and many of the same precepts actually apply to abusive relationships. The first one is to establish safety with an individual, allowing for trust to form without any accusation. The second is remembrance and mourning, which consists of a non-judgmental period of open listening. This allows the cult member to reframe and contextualize their experiences in their own words. And it doesn't reinforce those dangers of the outside world, which they've been constantly exposed to. And then the final one is to re-establish connections where they make a group a life outside of the group. So the connections with others can kind of have a protective effect against radicalization, and it helps them to sort of re-center themselves in the world and regain their identity.
Okay. Do we want to do we want to go through the high profile examples? I feel like we should because this is an occult podcast, so we could just maybe go through it semi quickly. Okay, I'll introduce this. Yeah, I think the deprogramming is something that I think is so hard for a lot of people who've been in cults. Obviously, like I'm not trying to make light of it. It's a really sensitive like subject to engage with somebody with and to walk kind of alongside them with as they go through that journey. So I just think being really kind and understanding and being willing to talk without judgment is like one of the best things we can really do. But it wouldn't be an occult podcast if we didn't talk about the intersection between the topic and kind of the spiritual community. So are there any high profile examples you can think of kind of dangerous cult, occult, or like cult witchy spaces that you've either come across yourself or that you've kind of seen in history or in your research? Ocean Wolf. You can cut that out.
LOL. Man, I feel like it's so hard to know where to even begin because, again, I feel like so many like theosophy started out kind of like a cult and was considered a cult in the early days. So I feel like some of these are like harder for me to think of concrete examples. I mean, one could even, I mean, I feel like Gardner himself was kind of culty in the beginning as well, which might be a bit spicy. But again, it's one of those things, right, where it's like, it can become not culty or it just is so convoluted. Yeah.
Any group that has a book blacklist is low-key entering cult vibe.
Oh my God. Oh man. Honestly, that was one of the things that inspired me to talk about my talk about cults on Discord, like book blacklists. Like, ugh, no.
Yeah, removing the
Like,
individuality, telling people what to think without even like letting them or recommending that they read the things that we're saying are bad. Yeah, and I saw so much beef online when like anybody questioned whoever made the blacklist, and it was just like people getting banned from servers, and I was like, this is not that deep, folks. Like, I don't know where all this is coming from.
Right. Or it's like one thing that I have often said, it's like this weird thing that people, where they think you have to believe in everyone else's belief system. And if you don't, you're bad. You should be banned from the server. I'm like, but huh? Huh? Like, that just doesn't make sense on a fundamental level. Yeah. Believing in what everyone else believes, but also to say that, like, you're a bad person if you don't believe in everything else someone believes, like, that's, come on, guys. Come on. I've noticed there's like this weird tendency of people who come from more high demand denominations, like evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. They tend to like recreate those same things just in like the opposite political spectrum. Yes. Or the opposite religious spectrum. Yeah,
we take all the trauma from the high control religion and then we paint it with pagan colors and it still exists in the same way.
Yeah,
there's, I'm not going to name names for my own sake of not being canceled. But I definitely like know within kind of the modern ceremonial space, like there are a select number of groups that to me are culty enough or like have enough red flags to stop me from engaging. If you want to know what they are, you can message me and I'll tell you, but I'm not going to say it publicly. And it's a lot of the same things, right? That there's a charismatic leader that everybody loves. There's like abuses and stuff kind of happening behind the scenes, spoken of in secret, not necessarily confirmed. But information control things where like, this is the way this is done. If you kind of think anything else, you're stupid or you don't know what you're talking about. And it's just like very, if not a cult, certainly in my opinion, like borderline culty.
Yeah, there's I was just looking it up. There's a name for the kind of person who switches from a very extreme belief to the opposite belief in a different direction. I think it's a political term. I think it's true believer syndrome, but I didn't manage to Google it quickly enough, so I didn't confirm that. But like, it is a known psychological thing where the extremity of somebody's views might be maintained, but it's just that they flip the orientation of them. And I think some of this kind of goes hand in hand with like spiritual bypassing, because somebody is kind of looking for a mode to be fulfilled by, but it's still that kind of extremity that they're kind of acting out on.
I mean, it's like we talked about this in our New Age episode about fundamentalism to New Age pipeline, and mm-hmm. also vice versa. I think that makes a lot of sense there.
Yeah, for sure. I agree.
Yeah, in terms of, oh, sorry, I was just going to...
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, in terms of examples, like, I think there are quite a few examples of, like, a cult crossover. Like, the Order of the Solar Temple is one, which I won't go into full details on, but, like, you can look it up. It's basically a Masonic group. Pretty horrible conclusion. It led to several mass suicides. And if you look at their beliefs, like, they are not so dissimilar to what we would describe as, you know, prevalent in the occult community. You know, there's a lot of theosophy in there, a lot of Rosicrucianism. But the problem with this is that a lot of the media at the time, and the anti-cult movement especially, pushed this idea that the root behind the you know, the horrible practices of this group was because they were involved with the occult. Obviously, we know that that's not true. We know it's because they had a charismatic, horrible leader who made them do all these things. But that's why I think it's so important for us to focus on like what is a cultic practice and distinguish that from a cultic belief, because something being, you know, said it many times, but like something being heterodox, deviant, alternative, whatever, does not make it dangerous inherently. It's about those controlling practices that you really need to look out for.
Oh, how did I forget? Twin Flames Universe. That's a current occult in modern day.
I've had that on my list since the last time you mentioned it, by the way. So yeah, I haven't managed to find it. No, because I don't have any streaming services, so I've been looking for it illegally to download. I haven't found it yet.
It was so interesting. They recently released an episode, I think it was on their YouTube channel, where Jeff and Shelia like sat down and tried to like, it was like some interview. And they tried to essentially convince the world that they're not a cult. It failed spectacularly. But then also like a bunch of their students got together on camera and were like trying to to say all the good that it's done, but like it was from an outsider perspective looking in, I was like, this is incredibly unconvincing and actually is doing the complete opposite and convincing that maybe this actually is a cult. But I think that's like a pretty good modern one that people might be familiar with. Any other cults we can think of? Any spicy cults that you want to throw out there?
No, don't, because I will be here all day. I've already been rambling.
Come on, Annie, let's get ourselves cancelled.
Well, I mean, should we get, like QAnon, for example.
Oh, yeah.
I would say that. But that's interesting because that does not, these days, have a centralized leader, right? Centralized charismatic leader. But does have a lot of the other kind of characteristics where there's kind of ideological, like, cohesion, that kind of thing. And, yeah, I mean, we could be here all day for this. And I would like to be, but...
Lucky, I think that MAGA is also a cult.
Oh, yeah.
100%. Like,
I would say so.
Yeah.
No, well, 100%.
Charismatic leader, don't think for themselves, don't check information. People pulling away from family members who don't agree. Like, it's kind of a larger spread. It's not so much like a one singular group. From like an ideological standpoint, I think certainly it fits the bite model.
Bite model stands for bite. Bite model, more like bite me model.
Okay, I think that's our cue to sign off, maybe. All right, so overall conclusions. Any final thoughts people have before I close us out?
Yeah, I guess my main final thought is that a lot of cult research and cult discussions are on people who join cults and not what people call like second generation adults like me, who I wasn't like born into it, but I was like young enough, like six, where like I did not have a pre-cult identity. Like I did not join a cult. So I think it's important to remember that like not everyone who's in a cult joined it. And oftentimes those people need more help because they don't have a pre-cult knowledge or pre-cult identity to fall back on. I would also like to re-emphasize, reiterate the like non-judgmental listening and security part as being super important when people are in a cult, because it's like I often was mad at people afterwards, was mad that no one said anything to me, but then I realized that like if they did, like it would have just pushed me further into the group. So having friends who were willing to tolerate me occasionally spouting bullshit was ultimately what led me to be able to take the steps to leave.
My thoughts, God, so many. I kind of came into this thinking that I knew a lot about cults, and then I went to do the research and I was like, wow, this is a mess. Like, I kind of did not realize just how academically poorly defined everything is. So I hope that we've given you a decent enough overview to kind of recognize some of these dangerous behaviors, but also just bear in mind, this is a really fraught and fuzzy and uncertain field. And so it's something that probably I think will develop more in the future.
Yep. I also was a little bit surprised that there wasn't more academic rigor behind a lot of the research, because people, especially like on the cult podcasts and stuff that I listen to, which is too many to be healthy, certainly. But they talk about a lot of things like the bite model or kind of other divisions and definitions of what a cult is, almost as if it's fact. And truthfully, like, it's not fact. There's a lot of debate that's happening in the academic community about these terminologies and how we're defining things and how we're delineating what like is and isn't a cult, or where kind of those boundaries are. And I think it's good for people to keep that in mind, right? That this is not a sort of well-defined thing. It's not necessarily factual, and there's not a ton of evidence that supports some of the more popular models out there, besides people being able to kind of fit them into it retroactively. So just always good to keep a skeptical perspective amidst such discussions. Hanny, what do you mean sex? What?
There's a podcast called Let's Talk About Sex, which is a really good one for cults.
Ah, brilliant. Okay. So let's talk about sext, S-E-C-T-S. it's going to get misheard on the podcast for sure. And then mine was from Parcast Network. It's just called Cults. Phil, do you have a cult podcast, like, series that you listen to?
No, I don't.
Fair enough.
It's a little too close to home for me. Yeah. So.
Nope. Makes sense. All right. Well, with that, we'll close this out. Thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you enjoy this discussion. Of course, we will see you during our next episode. And until then, have a good rest of your day. Bye, everybody.